Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome everybody to this 2024 series of Lionel Robbins lectures. I'm Richard Lael. I'm the co-director of the Wellbeing Research Programme in the LSE. And many, many years ago, I had the pleasure of working with Lionel Robbins. And it's a special pleasure to have with us his daughter, Anne. Anne, raise your hand. There. Lovely to have you here. Thank you. And two grandchildren. So that's wonderful. Apparently a great-grandchild was going to come, but had a cold. Nick, it's wonderful to have you giving these Robbins lectures, not for the first time. About 20 years ago, he gave these lectures on a similar topic, but of course the topic has become more and more serious as time has passed. Nick has greatly helped to make the topic more serious, and it does seem the time to revisit it at this crucial moment in the history of the world. So, just a little on his history. He studied maths at Cambridge. He studied economics with a PhD at Oxford. He was a professor at Warwick, and then we got him here. But then he left and became chief economist, first at the EBRD, then the World Bank, and then the Treasury, where he wrote the famous, or with others, he led the famous Stern Review, which is one of perhaps the most important publication that has come out in the whole debate about climate change. Eventually, Nick came back to us in 2007 as IG Patel Professor of Economics and Development and Chair of the Grantham Institute. So lovely to have you giving these lectures, Nick. Nick will talk for about 45 minutes, and then there'll be a welcome comment from Emily Shukra. Now, she is Professor of Environmental Data at Cambridge. She's a former member of the British Antarctic Survey, which is kind of intriguing. And she's also been, as I found this in Wikipedia, co-author with King Charles of the Lady Bird book on China climate change. So who could be better? So after Emily's comment, we'll then have half an hour for questions from you and from the online audience that I should have also said welcome to when we started. If you are online, please submit your questions through the Q&A function at the top left of your screen. And if you're a Twitter user, the hashtag is #LSERobbins. So, Nick, please tell us about the future of life on Earth.
Thank you, Richard. Let me begin with some really deep felt thank yous. Thank you to the Lionel Robbins family and Lionel Robbins committee, Richard Layard, for inviting me to do these lectures. And Lionel Robbins was a huge figure in so many ways, but particularly for us at the London School of Economics in the building of the economics department. Not only did he write his wonderful works, which I hope you're familiar with, but he also hired von Hayek, he hired John Hicks, Nicky Caldor, Arthur Lewis, Ronald Coase, some of the very biggest names in the history of our subject. And in the process of building the department, he happened to hire those extraordinary people. Not happened, because his judgment of what mattered was so good. In relation to what I'm talking about today, he was very much a person who understood the importance of entrepreneurship, of investment, of innovation, and of expectations. Indeed, the Austrian School of Economics is really quite close to a lot of his work. But he also thought deeply about global public goods And for him, the arts were of particular importance, and he saw the importance of finance for global public goods. And further, through his ideas on education, in which he expressed quite explicitly, he saw a common humanity in the right to advance yourself, to invest in yourself, to shape your future through education, and that the state had a duty to help you along that way. And that was very much a notion of common humanity and a right to development, which will run through much of what I have to say. So I feel very close in many ways to Lionel in terms of how he might have seen this whole set of issues had he been with us. I also want to thank so many different groups of colleagues. I can't name them, but in the Grantham Research Institute, in Stickard, in CP, Department of Economics, in Brookings, who I've been working closely with. Thank my co-authors, some of course who are here today, and from across the world, from Zhu Min in China through to Amar Bhattacharya and Joe Stiglitz in the United States, and everybody in between, including in large measure all the collaborators in India, a place very special to me. I'd like to thank those who got the Grantham Research Institute going, particularly, of course, Jeremy Grantham, who gave us the support, and the ESRC. And finally, to Delfina Godfried, Elena Subaran, Roberta Pierre Federici, and Eva Lee, who helped so much in putting these lectures together. And I'd like, since I'm talking about growth, to pay a special memory to and respect to Bob Solow, who died in December last year, absolutely at the core of economic growth, someone with whom I discussed these issues at great length and had a huge influence on me as an individual and as an economist. So those are the thank yous, and they're deeply felt. Let me now move quickly, and I'm going to go pretty fast through what I have to say. Let me say that the slides for all three lectures are already on the website of the Grantham Research Institute and of the Centre for Economic Performance. I'm not going to go through the slides in detail, but they are intended to be read independently of the lectures. So go back and have another look if you want to. I'm not going to go through each slide in detail. We'd be here for a very long time. But let me give you the basic storyline before launching into the detail. Why is this a growth story? Well, basically, the climate crisis requires very strong reaction, and at the heart of that reaction must be investment in the new, investment in the clean. At the heart of that reaction has to be systemic change, the way in which we run our cities, the way in which we use our land, our energy systems, our transport systems. This is about investment, innovatory investment, of course, and it's about systemic, structural, technological change. Investment is at the core, and that investment, if we do it well, and we can think about how to do it well, that investment will drive a new growth story. A growth story of the 21st century. I'm talking about growth over the next two or three decades. I'm not talking about growth forever. I don't think I quite understand what growth forever means. And remember Woody Allen, I don't know if you're allowed to quote him anymore, but he said eternity is a long time, especially near the end. And this is a story of growth and transformation and investment and innovation and systemic change over this next 20 or 30 years. So that's why it's a growth story, and it's a much better growth story than the one that went before. It's a growth story with cities where you can move and breathe and be productive, ecosystems which are robust and fruitful, much more resource efficiency than what went before, of course much healthier than what went before. So this is why I'm talking about the growth story of the 21st century. I do not want, great though the rewards are, including fundamentally, of course, the avoidance of the catastrophe of unmanaged climate change, great though the rewards are, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be rapid change, it's going to be a big investment and on great scale, and there'll be dislocation. So it will not be easy, and there will be pushback. So we have to recognise that whilst this is a tremendously attractive story, it's hard. And we have to put ourselves to work to understand just how we can help make that happen. What kinds of policies, institutional structures can deliver this growth story that we clearly need. So that's, if you like, an underlining of why the story that we're going to tell is in large measure one of economics, politics, and the social sciences. The biggest barriers to creating the growth story that I've described are in those areas. And the technologists actually are doing a pretty good job in creating the technologies that we need, and they'll go on. Of course, the policies that we're talking about will encourage that process. But the real obstacles to generating this growth story, this new way of doing things, lie in economics, politics, and society. That's why we have a duty as social scientists, particularly as economists, which is my particular trade, but why as social scientists we have a duty to really home in, and home in quickly, on these issues, because time is not on our side. This decade is absolutely decisive. In lecture one, I'm going to lay out how we got here, the nature of the challenges and the crises that we face, and the kinds of analytics we're going to need, particularly in ethics, economics, and politics, to take on those challenges. And I'll set out the agenda for rapid change and the beginnings of the growth story. Tomorrow is particularly for the economists, but tomorrow is the new growth story, what it looks like, what it involves, how it happens, and the dynamic analytics that we have to create in order to understand that properly. And I'll have some challenges to my fellow economists along the way. It will involve policies and institutions, and indeed a different view of the role of the state from the rather naive view of the role of the state that blossomed particularly amongst economists, but not only amongst economists, in the 1990s. So that's lecture two. Lecture three will be about the international side. This is par excellence, a global issue. All countries everywhere have to be involved in this story of transformation. And how do we generate those international collaborations? What kind of international collaborations do we need? And I'll pay particular attention to the area I've been working on intensely over these last few years, which is finance. This is a story of investment. Capital costs are at the core of that investment. So many countries in the world face very high capital costs. Poorer people in general face higher capital costs. How can you bring those down to facilitate the investment? It'll be much more than that, but that'll be a particular focus of lecture three. So there we are. That's what's coming. I've given you a synopsis of the storyline. Lots of work to do within it. I hope that you will see that I'm really optimistic about what we can do. I worry deeply about what we will do. And so if you think I'm getting overly optimistic about what we can do, well, I don't think it is overly optimistic, because what we can do, we can do. But will we do it? Will we overcome the obstacles in the economics and the politics and society? I don't know. It's our job to work so that increase the likelihood that we can, because if we can't, we're in deep, deep trouble, or at least our children and grandchildren in deep, deep trouble. So that's the agenda. I've told you what it's about. I've told you what's in the first in these three lectures. So let's move into this lecture. Start with how we got here. Where are we, and what are the problems involved? We'll look at the crises that have come with that, and how we find our way out of those crises and change our understanding of what sustainability is all about. Climate and biodiversity particularly particular importance, and they're particular importance because they give us the deadlines. You know, you can, if you're a bit late in fighting poverty, well, that's a shame, but you can still carry on doing it. If we're late in fighting this, climate and biodiversity challenges, then we're in deep trouble and likely create something that is irreversibly destructive. So it's the climate and biodiversity crisis that give us the time limits and the sense of urgency. The ethics, the economics, the politics will be the analytics that we have to bring to bear. And then the last two, the urgency and the action, and the agenda for analysis and action will be leading into lectures 2 and 3. Remember, because it's so urgent, we have to think and act at the same time. We can't take a research grant, come back in 5 years' time with some more ideas, including more ideas for further research. We actually have to get on with it and get on with it now. And that's the challenge of economic policy in general, to act and think at the same time. But it's particularly acute here because of the pressures of time. So let's look back now over this last 70 years since the Second World War. We've seen remarkable change. Income per capita times four, population times at least three, total income times a factor of around 13 in those 70 years, with, of course, given the dirty use of energy in creating that extra output, huge pressures on the environment. But still very high, very rapid increases in living standards, very sharp falls in poverty around the world. Very strong increase in life expectancy, more than 20 years from the 47 or so to around 70. That's quite extraordinary in terms of human history, increase in education and so on. It's been a remarkable change over 70 years, but because of the pressures that it's brought on our environment and in more recent times, particularly around social cohesion, it's a big success, which we have to recognise, but carrying with it all kinds of problems. Also, if we look within it, we can see that that progress differs greatly across the regions, much less strong in Africa, for example, on life expectancy and mortality. A lot of the people who have been lifted out of poverty are vulnerable to falling back in, as we've seen through COVID. And the big advances in democracy and in decolonization that we saw in those 50 or so years after the Second World War, we've started to see become eroded in the last 20 years with a much greater fragility than we might have anticipated 20-some years ago. What have been the ideas behind this story as we've tried to understand growth and change? Well, Roy Harrod focused our attention on investment, Bob Solow on technology. Investment and technology, economists have seen right through this period as absolutely critical. The wonderful work of Ken Arrow on learning by doing got behind that technological change, and that has started to transform the idea and our understanding of growth. And our colleague Philippe Aguillon here has taken that forward, bringing Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction to the understanding of technological change. But the story behind development in economics has in large measure been the accumulation of capital and technical progress, including within technical progress, the improvement in human capital. That's been the story. But now, as I've already emphasized, we have to focus much more strongly on structural and systemic change and technological change in terms of how it works through the structure and the systems, much more focused on that, those issues, systemic and structural, than we have in the past in economics. And of course, the environment itself will play a very powerful role in shaping what we can and what we can't do. When I started teaching development economics in the 1970s, structural change and system change was actually very much part of the agenda. In many ways, the great Arthur Lewis, in his theory of growth, he was thinking directly of systemic change, structural change, as you move out of subsistence agriculture into a more advanced system. It was central to the ideas of Indian planning associated with the name of Mulholland Obis, who was talking about machines to make machines. Right through that early period of development economics, there was a very strong emphasis on systemic and structural change. The reaction about sort of steering and planning came in the 1970s, certainly in India, and it really came to a head in many ways in the market fundamentalism and the Washington consensus of the 80s and particularly of the 90s. That did have some effect in pushing things in a direction of entrepreneurship and productivity, but it also carried with it a lot of serious issues around instability and inequality and social cohesion. Interestingly, the two countries that accelerated the most with the move towards entrepreneurship, private sector, and dismantling of some of the tools of planning were India and China, but of course they never swallowed, either of those countries, the market fundamentalism story. What they did recognize was the importance of the market and entrepreneurship, but that's very much less than the whole hog of the market fundamentalism that was there in the 90s. Of course, the rise of China itself has been enormously important in terms of taking people out of poverty and changing the structure of the world's economy, changing trade, and of course a very rapid rise in emissions associated with very rapid growth driven in large measure by coal. So that, if you like, was a very rapid run through 70 years of history, but it's very important to understand it because that's how we got where we are. We've now got to grapple with a whole series of crises associated with that history. We have degraded forests and land, a radical fall in the amount of the earth covered by forest, and a radical change in the quality of those forests. Degraded land across the world, disrupted marine systems, declining species, and the number of deaths caused by air pollution is just enormous. Outdoor air pollution kills 3 to 9 million people a year. It's very difficult to put a precise number on it, but that's huge. The number of people who die per year is not much over 50 million. So to have that amount associated with air pollution. And of course, that doesn't count all the lives that are maimed and distorted through the health problems associated with pollution. And it's brought increased the risks of pandemics. Those of you who want to see the relationship between pandemics and climate change and biodiversity, I'd recommend you look at some of the work of Lucy Shapiro at Stanford. But essentially, animals meet each other in all sorts of different ways. Birds meet each other in the Bering Straits that would never have met each other 30 or 40 years ago as a result of climate change. All kinds of viruses get exchanged and developed. Human beings, of course, moved much deeper into the territory of animals than before. There is a very close connection between the challenges of pandemics and the challenges of climate change and biodiversity. In this story, we've also seen pressures on social cohesion. Roughly speaking, within nation inequality went down for much of the 20th century. Roughly speaking, from the First World War to the 1980s, within country inequality, I'm generalizing, of course, across countries, did go down. But in the last 20 or 30 years, it has started to move in the other direction. Certainly in our own country, in the United States, very sharply through the 1980s. Not surprisingly, some connection there with the market fundamentalism that was part of that story. In the last 20 years or so, we've seen a decline in trust in terms of confidence in institutions. Last 20 years or so, we've seen a decline in press freedom. So we've seen in this last 20 years a reversal of some of those political advances and the strength of our democratic institutions and a reversal of social cohesion in terms of what's happened to inequality of income and wealth. I'm talking about within country income and wealth. Across countries, you're still seeing the poorer countries growing faster than the richer. So across countries, there's still some movement in a positive way around the reduction of inequality. But the social cohesion and the fractiousness and the difficulty has been associated, I think, in large measure with the way in which inequality has developed within countries. This is a sort of rather sad story of the crises that we've experienced over time, but these are the crises of the last 15 years or so. And you can see that many of those things, not all of them, of course, but many of them have been associated with the environment, and many of them associated with this rise of political difficulty, mistrust, less faith in institutions that we've seen over these last 20 or so years. I obviously can't go into great detail on this one, but it's very important to recognise that positive story of the better part of those 70 years is now increasingly a story of difficulty and fractiousness, and that is going to make life a bit more difficult to create the kind of international collaboration that we need on climate. But I do think that if you can find your way to collaborate on one issue, then you're going to do better in collaboration on other issues. And the one issue where we stand a better chance of international collaboration, where there's a stronger recognition that we're all in the same boat, is around climate and biodiversity. And if you look at the way in which the United States and China have wrestled with each other, the one area where they've tried to move together is around climate. In this story of growth and change, which I've spoken about, it's very interesting to reflect how our own attitudes to what it is that we're trying to measure, what is the metric of good performance, has changed. Of course, Keynes and Kuznets and the others around James Mead, around the Second World War and soon after, in response to the Great Depression, were very focused on output and employment. And that's the time where, as it were, GDP really came to the center of attention, because we were concerned with activity and employment. As we moved on through into the 80s and 90s, we started to see a much stronger focus on other metrics. Health and education, particularly important metrics there, but also you're starting to see, as you move into the 80s, a much stronger focus on the environment. That was reflected in the Human Development Report, Human Development Index, that very much associated with the work of Amartya Sen, came through in the around 1990, and then the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. The Millennium Development Goals, which were focused on particularly on output and food and health and education, but also to a modest extent on the environment in 2000. And then in 2015, you got the Sustainable Development Goals. Those of you who like badges will recognize I'm wearing a Sustainable Development Goal badge. But those then were very much, as the title carries, focused on sustainability. So there is a change that you can track associated with our experience and our understanding of what was happening, from simply output and employment through to health and education, but then also onto sustainability. Now, the big crises that we face are around climate and biodiversity. There you can see the very sharp rise in emissions. Emissions lead to increases in concentrations. Emissions are the flow, the concentration is the stock. And it's the stock of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that cause global warming. Essentially, the molecules oscillate at a frequency which interferes with the infrared energy escaping from the Earth, and that's the so-called greenhouse effect. Whilst concentrations are rising, temperature is rising because the amount of trapping is going up. Stabilizing concentrations is what we mean by net zero emissions. That the, if you like, if you think of the concentrations as the level in the bathtub, where the net flows are zero when the level of the bathtub stays constant, and that means there's the same amount going out as going in. And that crudely is the net zero story. And if we want to stabilize temperatures, we have to stabilize concentrations. And crudely, and we have a real climate scientist with us in Emily, but crudely speaking, that's what drives the idea of net zero. The emissions, sorry, as you saw in the previous slide, emissions come from everywhere, a very big increase in the Chinese contribution to emissions associated with the increase in output. Through that period, there's a very close relationship between emissions and output. Emissions come from all sectors. The AFOLU is agriculture, forestry, and other land use. That's a key source, but outside that, you can see it's basically associated with heating, electricity, transport, producing things, all involving the burning of fossil fuels. And you can see on the right-hand side here that it comes right across from right across the world. If we're going to be net zero, it means net zero everywhere, and it means net zero geographically, net zero everywhere across emissions. Now, not exactly that, because there will be some negatives, but the amount of negatives will be quite limited. So that's why the idea of net zero is so important here. 15 or 20 years ago, we were talking about cutting emissions by 80% between 1990 and 2050. It was amazing how many people thought they were in the 20% that didn't have to do any cutting at all. And that's why the net zero idea has become so powerful in this story, because it's clear that will have to involve everywhere. We're talking about emissions from everywhere, but not everywhere equally. If you look at the middle graph here, you've got, and the bar chart over to the left-hand side, you've got emissions per capita. Very big variations in emissions per capita. China overtook Europe in terms of emissions per capita 10 or 15 years ago, but China's emissions per capita still way below those of the United States. If you look at accumulated emissions over time, that's the right-hand chart here, you will see that USA is way out in front, China catching up, but actually it's not clear that China will ever catch up, because if China comes back to net zero by 2060, which is its target, then you will see, as it were, the gap closing. But you can see that historically speaking, United States has a very big part of the story, but so too, of course, the European countries, including the UK, where the Industrial Revolution kicked off. But that history of emissions is felt very strongly and understandably by the developing world. Part of the story and reaction says, you guys, you rich countries, got rich in a dirty way, and now just when we start to get going, you say the game's over and you can't stop growing. That politics is extremely important, and it's why it's so important that we can disentangle growth from emissions. Growth and development need energy, but energy does not need the emission of carbon. But that getting there involves a very big investment that we're talking about. So when we did the Stern Review, there were only three of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. There have now been four more, including the one on 1.5 degrees. But every one that's come along has been more worrying than the first. And the first was very seriously worrying. And every one after has become more worrying. We are on current policies and actions headed for somewhere between 2.5 and 3 degrees. Now, some promises will bring us down from that. But 3 degrees is life-changingly, civilization-changingly awful. We haven't been at 3 degrees for about 3 million years. The Homo sapiens has been around perhaps 250, 300,000 years. That would be way, way outside the experience of Homo sapiens. At that time, when we were last at 3 degrees, sea level was 10 to 20 meters higher than that. Now, we might be quite close to the seaside where we're standing now. This is, and remember how much of the world's population lives close to coasts. It would be absolutely transformational. And of course, the intensity of extreme weather events and the intensity of heat of a kind that human beings couldn't survive outside would be really intense at anything like a 3-degree world. This is just one example of the difference between 1.5 and 2. If you just take extreme heat here is defined as heat waves of the kind that Europe experienced in, say, 2003, with very big increases in deaths as a result. If you just go from 1.5 to 2, that goes up by a frequency of nearly 3. And, of course, a lot of these occurrences are life-terminating for many people. Not for everybody, but for many. That's just one illustration. All the coral would be gone at 2 degrees is a measure of the kind of change in the marine environment it would bring. These numbers are huge, and that's 1.5 to 2. You know, remember where it could be heading for 2.5 or 3. I won't say very much about climate and biodiversity, but I do think it's important to see them together. They're part of the same story. They have common drivers, particularly in the burning of fossil fuels, and they interact one with the other. A decline in biodiversity is bad for the climate. A decline in the climate is bad for biodiversity. Increasingly, the biodiversity has moved to center stage. I mean, climate got to center stage before biodiversity, but we should see them as very much interrelated. There is movement now on international agreements around biodiversity, but action is much too slow. And whilst most of the possibilities to act in conserving and restoring nature are in the poor parts of the world, that's not where the finance these activities is concentrated. So here is the paths that we need to follow. The green path is one of emissions for 1.5, the yellow for 2, and you can see that we're nowhere near those paths. We have to accelerate, and that means action, as I've shown, across the whole of the economy and the whole of the world. We can see, given what's happening to us at 1.2 degrees where we are now and the risks of 1.5, that we're going to have to do a whole lot of adaptation along the way. It's not just a story of cutting down emissions. Fundamentally important, though, that is. The changes that we're already experiencing are going to do big challenge for adaptation and resilience. Fortunately, as we'll see tomorrow, a lot of what we need to do for adaptation and mitigation and development are wrapped up together. I mean, mangroves, just one example, restoring degraded land, decentralized solar, public transport. Those are all mitigation, adaptation, and development wrapped up together. But the adaptation side of the story has to be big, given what we've already created. So that's the end of the story of the crises that we have to deal with and how we have to respond. And these are the dimensions of the response: innovation, dealing with market failures, internationalism, particularly around the multilateral development banks, and managing a just transition where the dislocation involved in the change we're talking about is really significant. So let's move to the analytical story of dealing with the kinds of issues and change which I've just described. And let me start with the whole idea of sustainability. Sustainability is offering opportunities in terms of potential well-being to future generations which are at least as good as our own. Most definitions of sustainability are something like that. I prefer to do it in terms of opportunities. Brundtland, who was pioneering in this, described it in terms of needs. I find opportunities more easy to understand than needs. And essentially, it's about what we're offering to future generations in terms of those opportunities. It means, in that sense, seeing a common humanity between our position and their position, a shared equality, if you like, in terms of opportunity between our generation and the generations to follow. In most Western philosophies, you know, going back here, I've got, you know, Kant and Paine and Mary Wollstonecraft and Rousseau, all from the 18th century, seeing that idea of the common right to development. And it's, of course, enshrined in the Declaration of Independence itself, you know, the pursuit equal in people's right to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's about the right to development, the right to shape your own life. In the language of Sen, in the language of Sen, it's shaping one's own life in terms of what you have reason to value. And that seems to me the fundamental ethical basis of sustainability. It's common right across Aristotle and Kant and Paine. Indeed, goes back to John Locke in the previous century. And indeed, if you go back a lot further, you can trace it to Aristotle and Plato as well. This is a very deep idea of common humanity and equality of rights to development, which for me, in large measure, drives, and I'm very far from alone in this, but most people, I think, who are thinking about sustainability, drives the importance of it home in terms of what we think about what human beings have in common. If you want to be really technical in terms of modern welfare economics and social welfare functions, you're talking about symmetry of the social welfare function. If one utility is associated with Smith and the other utility is associated with the name of Jones, and you just swap them over, but otherwise it's still the same set of circumstances. In other words, there's still a person who has the consumption pattern and everything else that was called Smith, except he's now called Jones, yeah? Or she's now called Jones. That's symmetry, if you like, in terms of modern theory of social welfare functions and so on. But that's a technical one. The deeper story, I think, is the common humanity. So that idea of sustainability takes us to goals, sustainability goals, goals and metrics. It takes us to the question, what determines the opportunities of future generations? And they're basically, their opportunities are determined in terms of the endowments that they have. Physical capital, human capital, natural capital, and social capital. The physical and the human capital has been in our growth story as set out in economics for a very long time. But the natural capital and the social capital, much less so. And if we're thinking about sustainability, we have to be very clear that we have to be talking about all those sources of capital. Now, Richard is telling me I'm out running out of time. The right to development does not imply the right to emit the greenhouse gases. The greenhouse gases kill people. There's nothing in the right to development that tells you that you can kill people and destroy their opportunities. As the wonderful Meles Zenawi, who I work very closely with, the outstanding Prime Minister of Ethiopia, said at COP17, 2011, he said, it's not justice to foul the planet because others have fouled it in the past. But there is still, and many of us would argue, a very big responsibility through the patterns of growth which the rich countries have followed in the past, which have hindered the right to development of poor countries, to support them in finding a different way of doing things. And we know we can find a different way of doing things. I've got the whole theory of discounting in two slides. The economics world has done it very badly. It's about how well off people will be in the future, and it's about how much you care about people in the future. I've already argued that there's no reason to discriminate by date of birth. Two identical people, who one happens to be born 10 years after the other, I think in most systems of moral philosophy would be treated equally. But an extra unit to people who are richer, most people, it's an ethical judgment, but most people would regard an extra unit to people who are richer as less valuable than to people who are poorer. That's the way to think about discounting. As soon as you do it that way, you recognize that there's no external discount rate that you can use because it depends on what we do. And you realize there's no way that you can get discounting from the capital markets. And action in the capital markets is not an ethical judgment or statement. A lot of the capital markets are about risk, and risk, in my view, should be treated separately in terms of the analytics. And of course, those markets are very imperfect. So there you are, that's two slides on the discounting. In our economics, we've been quite slow in picking up on these issues of fundamental structural transformation. That's a challenge which I'll develop tomorrow. The analytics have been very much equilibrium models, and they've not dealt with the magnitude when we're talking equilibrium models with very little in the way of systemic transformation. They've usually had only one market failure, which is the greenhouse gas, when we have to think of many, and I'll go into that again next time. So the politics that we have to, I've spoken about the ethics, the economics, and the politics. The you'd have to give me five more minutes, Richard. I'm not far away. But so on the politics side, the left-hand side, you've got the challenges of dislocation and pushback and vested interests and false information. On the right-hand side, you've got the challenges of building collaboration. Both parts of that story, of course, involve real challenges to our ability to handle politics. Not impossible, but we cannot pretend that it's going to be easy. Managing a transition in an equitable way, what we call a just transition, is going to be critical to that. I'll be talking a lot about building international collaboration the day after tomorrow. So this is where we are. After looking back, thinking about the crises that we face, thinking about the analytics that we need. This next decade is critical. There's a typo in that slide. The 60% here should be 43%. If you go to your slides on the on the website, that's corrected. And I should say, if anybody else finds errors on the slides or inconsistencies, please let me know. That one's a typo, but it's already corrected on the website. But basically, what I wanted to emphasize here is that this next 15, 20, 30 years will see a doubling of our infrastructure. It will see, over 25 years or so, a doubling of income, and it will see a doubling of our urban population in about 30 years. If we build that infrastructure, if we grow in this next 20 or 30 years, anything like how we built our infrastructure and grown in the past, then we will be in deep, deep trouble. We really will be heading for a 3 degrees world. That's a measure of the sense of urgency. Those things which we know are going to be built, those investments which we know are going to take place, have to be done in a very different way. And because of the time we've lost, the investment rate has to go up. So it's a very big investment story with a number of my colleagues, Amar Bhattacharya and others, and Vera Songwe. We've tried to quantify what those investments look like. We're talking about an increase in the investment rate now of 2 or 3 percentage points in the world, 4 or 5 percentage points in much of the developing world. We have to act strongly now because we've acted so slowly in the past. Why have we acted slowly in the past? Because there's been the idea that somehow there's a horse race between growth and development on the one hand and climate action on the other. We haven't taken the claims of future generations seriously, and we've missed out on much of the environmental damage our actions have caused. The cost of capital, remember this is all about investment, for many developing countries the cost of capital is far too high. The difficulties of managing the dislocation, the vested interests have been pretty good at pushing back in this area, and most recently we've had tension and friction internationally. Those are the reasons why we've moved so slowly, and those are the kinds of things that we have to overcome in our economics and politics and society and international collaboration. So here's the agenda. This is what we're going to be talking about tomorrow and the next day. This is what we have to tackle as a world. We have to share a discussion about what it is that we value, what our objectives are, and build metrics on the back of that. Sustainable Development Goals, one example. We have to have an analytics in economics and the social sciences, which is all about rapid change. And we're going to have to bring different perspectives to the table. There's no way we're going to get by with one model. We shouldn't try. We're going to have lots of different kinds of perspectives that we bring to the different parts of the challenge. And then we have to put it all together with wisdom and judgment. These are the areas that we have to bring our analytics to. Expectations, investment's all about expectations. Lana Robbins, Hayek, Keynes, they made that absolutely centre stage. We've got to tackle the just transition. A lot of the problems of investment are associated with the big debts that developing countries face, some of those particularly associated with COVID. So these are the areas where we have to bring our analytics to bear. So we've got the agenda. We know what we're trying to tackle. We can see the kinds of investments and systemic changes that we have to bring about. I'm going to argue that we really can do what we have to do, but will we do it? Well, I'll talk through the story of growth and what's involved, and the story of international collaboration and what's involved in the next two lectures. To coin a phrase, yes, we can, but will we? On that, I worry. Thank you.
Nick, what a wonderful sweep. What an incitement to come to your next lectures. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So, Emily.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Nick. This first lecture of Nick's was very much about, if you like, diagnosing the challenge. And so what I thought I would do is say just a few words from a climate scientist's perspective about diagnosing the challenge to complement what Nick has already outlined. And there's really two key messages that I want to provide. The first one is that in many ways, I would argue that climate change is happening faster than we probably realize. Some of you may remember Al Gore's film, The Inconvenient Truth. And towards the beginning of that film, there was an analogy of a frog being slowly boiled in water, not realizing that it was being boiled. And I would suggest that in some ways, that's what's happening to all of us. Nick mentioned the importance of the concentrations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and how important that is for determining the scale of climate change. When the Paris Agreement was agreed in 2015, the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere were 400 parts per million. I looked up just this afternoon where carbon dioxide levels are now, and they're now almost 425 parts per million. That's a 25 part per million increase in less than a decade. And that's translated through to also a significant increase, of course, in temperatures. Back when the Paris Agreement was, the gavel came down, temperatures were just touching 1 degree Celsius of warming compared to pre-industrial times. Last year, it was 1.45 degrees of warming. Warmer because we were also in an El Nino year, but nevertheless, still significantly warmer than it was even a decade previously. And if we look at the month of February this year, February was 1.77 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial times. Climate change is really happening fast. And again, we saw this in this country when temperatures breached 40 degrees Celsius in many locations across the country, something that came as a shock, quite frankly, to many climate scientists. And that's not all. I could keep going on across the climate system. Sea surface temperatures at the moment are extraordinarily warm, and as scientists, we don't entirely understand why. For a long time, sea ice in the Arctic has been showing really dramatic decline, but the Antarctic sea ice hadn't seen that large amount of decline until last year, when suddenly we saw dramatic decline of sea ice in the Antarctic as well. Around the world, we are seeing dramatic signs of change, and I would argue more strongly than many recognize. So that's my first key message. My second key message is that if we look to the future and future risks, I suggest that in many instances those risks are underestimated by many, and in fact particularly maybe by many economists, because I think that the risks in large part are structural and systemic, and that many of the risks are highly nonlinear. The most obvious example of a nonlinear change is in terms of sea level rise. Even if we stabilise temperatures in the way that that Nick described, with a stabilisation of concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we would still see sea levels continue to rise long into the future because of a delay in the climate system. That's one example of nonlinearities, and there are many others that I could describe. One of the ways in which the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, characterises the risks of climate change is in a summary diagram that's been put together over the last three of the IPCC assessment reports, which sometimes is called the Burning Embers Diagram, sometimes called Reasons for Concern. It aggregates all of the scientific information within the IPCC reports in categories of concern, one of which is associated with what the IPCC calls unique and threatened systems. And Nick gave one example of such a system of coral reefs, where significant damaged coral reefs is already observed. And if we start breaching 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, then the very existence of coral reefs starts to become threatened globally. But another key category in terms of those reasons concern is around tipping points. And again, Nick mentioned some of these. He mentioned the risk of the integrity of the ice sheets in the polar regions. And when he described in the past that when the world was around 3 degrees warmer than it is today in the, compared to pre-industrial times, in the distant past, sea levels were some 10 metres higher than they are today. That is because in that distant past, in that warmer world, the ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica were not intact. That shows very clearly that there is a risk of the integrity of those ice sheets as we warm the world. And there are many other tipping points that we're aware of in the climate system, from the Amazon rainforest, switching from a rainforest into a much drier, low tree state, or tipping points in terms of the ocean circulation, tipping points and feedbacks associated with methane, either stored in the frozen land in the Arctic or in tropical wetlands. All these things could lead to very dramatic changes that have potentially existential risks to either parts of the natural world or indeed to societies. The second key element that is a real characteristic of climate-related risks is that they're highly networked. There's a good example at the moment of very low water levels in the Panama Canal, which is having global consequences in terms of supply chains. And those low water levels thought to be partly a consequence of the El Nino conditions, but also partly a consequence of climate change. Many other examples of networked risks. We also know that many climate-related risks can have cascading impacts. There were very high temperatures, almost 50 degrees Celsius in British Columbia in 2021, resulted in extreme wildfires suddenly bursting out. So you might have remember seeing some of the devastating images of that. And then just a few months later, there were severe floods, which were that much more severe because they were heavy rainfall on very parched land and the water couldn't drain away. That's just one of many examples where you start to get these cascading effects where one climatic change creates the environment where the next climatic change is that much worse. We've heard Nick mention the health impacts of climate change and how many different ways in which we're seeing health around the world being impacted by climatic changes, either directly or through the spread of disease. We saw in Paris this year parts of Paris being fumigated because of the potential transmission of dengue. Dengue is a disease that's steadily spreading around the world as the habitats for the mosquitoes that spread it are becoming increasingly favourable. as a consequence of climate change. You also heard Nick mention the challenges in terms of social cohesion, but he could have mentioned migration or the drivers of conflict, transboundary disputes associated with water. There are so many different ways in which climate change is starting to have very real risks to geopolitical stability and integrity. All of that comes together to create a sense that these really are systemic risks. They really are structural risks. They're going to require systemic and structural responses. And I'll just leave with one key phrase that came from the most recent IPCC report, which I think encapsulates all of that, which is that there is a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emily. Now, it's your turn. Who wants to speak?
I'd like to ask a question.
Please say who you are and ask a question.
Wait for a microphone. Now, I'm Professor Tegidwin Jones, and I used to be the leader of the elementary particle physics at University College London. I am 17 years beyond my first sell-by date, but in those years I have been preparing courses for students and even preparing a course that non-experts could learn a lot. Now the question I'd like to ask to Lord Stern is, I think we've got to get to the particular. How much do you think the net zero will cost this country?
I think that's the wrong question.
Oh, very, very good. So what is the correct question I should be asking?
How do we get to net zero?
Yes.
What are the investments that are associated in doing that? What are the systemic and structural transformations that are involved?
Yes, but let's ask
and then, we can ask ourselves, and I, with my colleagues, answered that question, that we have to invest in the UK another 1 or 2 percentage points of GDP.
Yes, I believe your
figure. We have to... Why don't you let me try to answer, yeah?
Yeah, I believe...
No, why don't you let me try to answer? So we can describe what we have to do to get there. We can describe the changes. We can talk about the investments that are necessary, both in terms of quantity and in terms of sector and the type of investment they are. We can describe the returns to those investments in terms of efficiency, in terms of productivity, in terms of cleaner air. And then we can look at what's involved, and that's the way we ought to be asking our question.
Well, let me ask you a question.
No, sorry, I think we move on to the next person.
No, I do want to answer.
No, please, we'll move on to the next person.
Well, this is supposed to be an academic discussion, which I wish to continue. And the
you can continue it afterwards, please. Hand the thing to the next person, please.
Please, I have no intention of doing that. I'm going to ask my question with a question to you.
No, you have to be fair.
All right,
can talk about it afterwards. Hand it over to the next person, please.
Well, let me make one comment. You have claimed in a previous paper that the cost of the transition in the United Kingdom is £50 billion a year based on the climate change figures. Do you agree with that?
I've talked about investing another 1 or 2 percentage points.
Well, that is
GDP. The 2% would be about 40.
That's 2% would be about 50 billion.
So this is investment. You don't seem to understand what my answer is. This is about investment with very powerful returns. It's a serious intellectual mistake to see an investment as a cost when that investment brings all sorts of other benefits
agree
with
you.
It.
But we should not. But I think you should know of a very serious new development, which I will now repeat.
We'll have to do this at the end. Hand over the thing, please, to the other.
Well, may make well,
to the next person. No, you've had one. Okay.
Thank you, David Shukman. Seeing the name Trump in one of your slides, Nick, and striving to be optimistic. Is there a scenario where the costs of renewables and all clean technology have fallen to the extent where it doesn't matter so much who's in power? I mean, can the transition happen regardless of the febrile politics here and the prospective politics in the United States? Thank you.
Up to a point, yes. The clean is already cheaper than the dirty, and I'm going to talk about this at some length tomorrow. The clean is already cheaper than the dirty across around 25-30% of emissions. If we run forward the way in which technology is moving in different parts of the economy, the clean will be cheaper than the dirty in 8 or 9, 10 years' time across perhaps 70% of the emissions and activity. That's, again, something I'll go into more detail. And that has changed the facts on the ground. And the Texans are investing a great deal in wind and solar, not necessarily out of altruism for the climate, because it's cheaper. That depends enormously on the cost of capital, because a lot of this is about moving capital investment up front and, of course, saving on the costs down the track of fossil fuel inputs. But the cost of capital is critical. And in the rich countries, it's much lower than in the poor countries. So one of the main barriers, as I argued, to investment in the poorer countries is the cost of capital. But there's lots we can do about that. And that's what development banks are for, and it's what the IMF can help. There's a great deal of ways in which we can bring down the cost of capital. But the key is the clean being cheaper than the dirty, which is your question. And I do think that that is sufficiently strong and sufficiently entrenched that investment in renewables will go on even if he's elected.
Thank you. A little bit of optimism
there. Yeah, there are all sorts of other things that he could mess up.
Yes, of course.
Yes, my name is Stefano Bonfa. I am from Oxford Sustainable Development. I strongly believe, Professor Stern, the principle. The question is, where are the data? First question. Second question is, you don't think the educational should move toward more evidence? The educational aspect from university up to, let's say, elementary. We are working, for example, in building big data innovation hub in the Mediterranean countries with the idea of climatological change. We have a big difficulty at political level, and that is the main constraint, because funding, investment, they are not based on knowledge, on evidence. So the question is, I would like to see more an observatory of data, not observatory of climatological reports, where then this become a knowledge and this become a really, let's say, a motivation for bottom-up approach and adaptation of climate. Thank you.
Thank you. Everything that Emily and I have been talking about has been evidence-based, whether it's the science or the technology or the cost of capital, which I've been talking about. It's evidence-based. Do we need more evidence? Always. Do we need to act on the evidence we've got already? Yes, we do. And I think that's the way we have to advance. There's a whole collection of slides with all the references that I made in the main body of the slides. And you know, Emily has been working away on the science for many years. But we have to collect our evidence and we have to act at the same time. We can't wait until all the data is in. Having said that, I do think that we've had a bit of luck. We haven't had much luck, but we've had a bit of luck in the sense that the artificial intelligence surge has come just when we've needed it. And the interaction between the green investment and artificial intelligence is going to be helpful. Why? In the discovery of technologies, for example, in fusion and materials. Why? In terms of running big systems. If you're trying to run a big energy transport city system, that kind of approach will be helpful. So I think that's one positive part of the story. But if you ask, do we wait until all the data is in, then no. Do we collect much more evidence quickly? Yes. But we have to act on what we've got.
Can I just add one key thing there on the adaptation in particular, because where there still is, I think, an evidence gap currently is in terms of really understanding climatic change at a local level. Because that's what you need to understand in order to really properly put in place the right adaptation at a local level. And actually, that's another potential advantage or application of the latest AI technologies. One of the areas that we're doing a lot of, I and my research group are doing a lot of work on in Cambridge, is precisely using AI approaches to bring more of the very locally relevant information associated with the climate, to give that higher granularity of information precisely for helping to inform adaptation-based decisions.
Why AI cannot be data?
AI and big data. AI, in this context, we're just using as an approach to be able to integrate that vast amount of data. So it's, we're using it as a tool to integrate the data into our decision-making processes.
So now we'll have some questions from the online. Where is Martin? Oh, you're there, sorry.
We've got perhaps...
You're going to read us three questions?
I can read you two, I think, that we've got here. First one was talking about where you touched on how this responsibility will be at the cost of younger generations to come. And they're asking, how can we support younger generations in becoming, you know, part of the solution to climate change? And the other, well, quite a few people online were concerned about geographical inequalities and seemed to be curious to know whether the pursuit of combating climate change would come at a cost to developing countries over those in the West.
So could you say that again?
They wanted to know whether the price of combating climate change would come at the cost of developing countries over those in the West.
Well, one thing you can do to help younger generation is send them to London School of Economics, where we teach and work on this, and to Cambridge, let it be said. But I think young people should ask of their universities, how focused are they on the big issues of our time and what intellectual inquiry can bring on the big issues of our time. There's lots that young people themselves can do. They decide how to travel, they decide how to heat their homes, they decide what to eat, they decide where to put their pensions, because most of them will be involved in contribution schemes rather than defined contribution rather than defined benefit schemes. So there's lots they themselves could do. And of course they can be very active politically, and they should. And one of the joys of being a university teacher is that you get older, but they stay the same age. And different cohorts come through. And they are currently pushing us very hard on these issues, and so they should. But in terms of opportunities that this generation offers to the next, it's around the four types of capital that I emphasized, around the physical capital, the human capital, the health and education, the natural capital of the environment, and social capital, slightly more nebulous, but around social cohesion, inequality, ability to work together, and so on. Oh, and the geographical story. In what I said, I emphasised that it has the biggest contribution to past emissions has been in the developed world, the rich world. We got rich in a dirty way that put concentrations of greenhouse gases up in the atmosphere. Now, of course, the growth that's coming will be, the majority of it will be in the developing world, but in the data that I put out, you saw that still the historical responsibility of the rich world was very strong. So if you take a right to development approach, we as a rich world have hindered the right to development of the poor world. There is then a responsibility to help with the huge opportunities now to leapfrog over the dirty phase that we went through of how we got rich. That can only happen if the capital is made available on reasonable terms. I'll be talking about what reasonable terms mean in my next two lectures. So the responsibility then is to help leapfrog into a much better path of development, in large measure through the supply of capital. That way, the developing world will have the benefit of a different way of growing and changing. That's, of course, theirs to choose. It's not for us to to preach or to lecture, but it is for the richer world to help in that process through the ways that I've described. And that will be a much better path for development than that followed before. Development needs energy. Energy does not need carbon. The clean is cheaper than the dirty over a big part of the story. We used to have a tradition of gender balance in questions.
Hello, my name is Thomas Rice. Referring to agriculture, how important to reducing emissions do you see genetic engineering? Thank you.
The transformation of agriculture will be a big part of the story. No-till system of root intensification for rice, where you don't flood the paddy field, you plant in a different way, you economise on the water. And of course, if you don't flood the paddy field, you don't release the methane. A lot of the story will be about shifting diets. Now, nothing in what I've just said mentioned genetic engineering. So first part of my answer is there's a great deal you can do along the lines I've described. Will we need new varieties which are resistant to or able to flourish in with different climates? Yes, we will. And in my younger days, one of my first applied research projects was on tea in Kenya and then in wheat in India. And the second of those was very much about the Green Revolution and new varieties. They were actually hybrids. They were bred rather than genetic engineering. But in changing the kind of varieties that are resistant, that adapting to the new climate, in changing our agriculture so that we have less emissions, I gave the system of root intensification for rice. Some varieties will be better equipped than that. So it will play some role. What I don't want to pretend is that it is absolutely critical. We can't get anywhere without it. I think it will help.
Hi. Thanks for having us. Dave Gibson, Head of Climate Change and Sustainability at Zurich Insurance UK. Head of Climate Change and Sustainability for Zurich Insurance UK and Development.
You guys carry the can.
Focusing on adaptations, I'm a bit worried. Over the last little while, we saw a shakeup in Shell attributing their share prices against Exxon and Chevron going lower because of their focus on ESG, perhaps. Over the last months, we saw banks back out of the CA100. I'm worried about one step forward, two steps back. Can you comment?
Yeah. The first comment is I share the worry. But the next thing is what to do. Yeah? And I think the pushing for the investment in the new, really supporting investments outside those, they don't do much wind and solar yet. Strong support for wind and solar will be a big part of the story. So the first part of the answer is to encourage the alternatives. Second part of the answer is taxation. Tax carbon, have a carbon price, tax the super normal profits. And to some extent, that's what has been taking place. But subsidize, you might have to subsidize the alternatives for a bit, but encourage the alternatives. You can do a lot with reducing risk and uncertainty and feed-in tariffs, and tax carbon and tax the super normal profits. You can regulate as to how much carbon you are allowed to emit. So it's going to be a mixture of encouraging the alternatives and making the dirty more expensive. And I do think that the steps that you saw amongst energy companies, in BP and Shell, were steps in a positive direction. And I don't believe that will necessarily evaporate. And if you look at the history of industrial revolutions, you know, a lot of the railway companies in the United States went bust. There are going to be ups and downs in this story. So I think that turn, which you're describing, which is real, is, I hope, temporary. And I tried to describe some methods why, through which you can encourage it to be temporary.
And maybe actually just coming back to the question that was online, yes. The voice of young people is incredibly important here and helping to keep the pressure up in terms of driving that direction forwards. There was I was on a panel last year, the day after there was the fracking debacle vote in this country with the, Graham Stewart, the minister, and I was cycling into my then 9-year-old daughter into school and telling her that we listened to the Today programme in the morning, so she'd heard that there was some saga going on about fracking and so forth. She said to me, I said to her, well, what do you know? I'm going to be on the panel with the minister later this morning. What do you want me to tell him? And she said to me, tell him that we're not mermaids, because 9-year-olds like that, and that we can't, we won't survive if we have significant climate change and sea level rise, and tell him that they might be the ones, he might be the ones taking the decisions, but we're the ones that are going to be suffering the consequences. No, this is true, right? This is the intergenerational issue,
certainly.
And it is really important that young people's voices are heard in this whole debate. And maybe we should send some young people to go and speak to the likes of Shell and others.
But it's of critical importance to reduce the demand for their product. I mean, we as a world are still demanding fossil fuels. So the kind of changes that we're talking about are a whole scale shift in demand away. So, the examples I gave were part of that story, but the kind of system change we're talking about is a much bigger one of moving away as fast as possible from those products. And fast is possible.
Good evening. Thank you for your time. Peggy Sue from the University of Toronto, the Creative Destruction Lab, as you cited, the thematic mention. So as someone who's a part of an institution, I often struggle with the reality that we charge international students significantly more than we do to those who are attending from domestic regions. With consideration to the fact that we have made it so, that we've made our locales so wealthy through these dirtier processes, yet to access these education models, there is a significant financial barrier to entry. And I know specifically from North America, not just educationally, but then access to jobs, continued employment, visa challenges, borders. So what role is it that you think that educational institutions will play in helping to really disseminate this equality to the regions that we have deprived? But deprived really is a debilitating word. How is it that we listen and offer the wealth of our education to these regions so that they can show us what they would like to develop to solve their problems?
I think the answer lies in large measure in finance. I mean, what we would like to have in the LSE is the ability of people to come here on the basis of quality so that we can provide scholarships to those students. So I wouldn't actually change the price. I'd change the ability to come, and that means finance and it means scholarships, just as we have to lower the cost of capital so that the big leapfrog and doing things in very different ways can happen in terms of flows of resources in, which will be in large measure private sector resources. We have to lower the cost of capital, or indeed in many ways if we can do it through grants, to get people here who qualified, who want to come, who could benefit from what we have to offer. I wouldn't do it by blanket reduction in fees.
Is there someone at the back? Yes, there, right at the back.
Hi, Anna Pluta, LSE alumna. What can be done to make financial markets and specifically environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG, more effective so as to channel the investment in the right way. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, greenwash on the one hand, and what are practical measures to improve the quality of ESG?
Yeah. I think I'd start by disentangling ES and G. You know, the kind of thing that they're all important, but they're very different. And to sort of throw them into one group is a bit worrying, because what we're talking about here is investment and change that makes the clean cheaper than the dirty. We're talking about changing systems, changing technologies, and those are the kinds of investments that we want to encourage. So somehow, if you put them all together, it looks like what sort of money should you push in the cuddly, nice direction, when what we're talking about are real problems of fundamental change in the way in which we produce and consume and construct our cities and construct our agriculture. So I'd much prefer to see it in terms of investment and change, as I've tried to couch the whole argument, rather than some kind of footnote or double bottom line or triple bottom line. It's about just changing the way we do things. And I think bundling it under ESG looks kind of soft and charity when we should be talking about something very different.
Hi, this is Leah. I'm a consultant in a management consultancy in London. So I have a question to Emily and Lawson. So actually, so far what we have seen every time during the recession time, all both government and companies, they would become more conservative on doing the investment or push into the sustainability. So I wonder, what do you think about it and what might be the solution? Especially consider we might be already in recession, especially like UK. And also, if we consider Europe, actually now is leading on sustainability. But if Europe also go into economy recession, then who would leading the change?
Yeah. My whole argument is about driving out of investment and onto a new growth path through investment in the new and the innovative and the clean. So the challenge is to increase investment through the kinds of ways which I was trying to describe, and I'll go into much more detail tomorrow about how we foster investment. But we shouldn't accept recession. We don't have to. We know enough economics now not to do that. And what you don't do is cut investment during recessions. And that's what worries me at the moment, where we seem to see a cut in government investment right at the time when we need it, not only to get the economy moving, but still more fundamentally to get onto a different growth path. And to borrow for sound investment is fiscally responsible. Not to borrow for sound investment is fiscally irresponsible. And we need to actually make that happen. And that discussion needs to take place much more fiercely in this country and elsewhere than it has done up to now. The way out of the recession is investment. The way onto the new growth path is investment. It's investment in the new and the clean. And we have to, in some ways, we have to borrow to do that. But it will be investment with very high returns, which actually will bring down over time the debt to GDP ratios.
Well, Nick, what a wonderful start. We're looking forward to all the answers you're going to give tomorrow and the day after. What you've really done is set this whole thing in a much wider context than it's usually looked at. I mean, we knew that that's what you stand for. And I think that is really important that we look at this as an opportunity as well as a burden. And that's really, really an absolutely crucial message. So please come next time. And thank you both so much for your wonderful contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. you can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.